for these evenings, that we begin by exhorting you to remember what a wonderful and unique organization the Vancouver Institute is, and to gently remind you as well that it's one of the best bargains in town. $5 for students, $15 for single memberships, and $25 for family memberships, and you can purchase those memberships just at the door as you came in. There was a table there. And as an extra delight at that table tonight on your way out, if you haven't already got one, please do pick up a ticket for next Saturday night. Robert Silverman, the renowned Canadian pianist, will be giving a lecture and concert on performing Beethoven, and that will be at the Chan Chun Center at the north end of campus. Okay, now it is indeed my very distinct and great pleasure to welcome our speaker tonight and to introduce him to you. Our speaker is Dr. Herbert Adam. And Dr. Adam it's a delight for me to welcome him here for several reasons. He's, of course, a very distinguished scholar, and I'll say more about that in a moment. He is from Simon Fraser University, our sister university, so it is very nice indeed to have you here at UBC. He has many close ties with UBC and has co-published with scholars here at UBC. But perhaps most significantly, he's going to speak to us tonight on a topic of great interest and timeliness. Dr. Adam is a professor of sociology at SFU, and he began his studies at the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, but he has held several visiting appointments over the years and won many awards and distinctions. His areas of specialization include critical theory, ethno-nationalism, and race relations. And he applies these areas of expertise geographically to South Africa, about which we'll be hearing this evening, to Germany, and to Canada. Over his distinguished career, he has published 140 articles and 10 books. Amongst these books, I'll mention just a few, and you will find these also outside at the entrance as you were coming in when you go out. Modernizing Racial Domination, Ethnic Power Mobilized, South Africa Without Apartheid, The Opening of the Apartheid Mind, Comrades in Business, Post-Liberation Politics in South Africa. This last book is just recently published, not yet available in Canada, but we will look forward to being able to buy it here soon. Dr. Adam's title tonight is Contradictions of Liberation, Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation in South Africa. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Herbert Adam.
Dr. Grace, colleagues and friends, ladies and gentlemen, I feel flattered by your generous introduction. I feel honored by the invitation to talk to such a distinguished audience. And I feel humbled and somewhat intimidated by the expectations you have of that lecture. What adds to my anxiety is that in the audience is my UBC spouse, who a few days ago said to me, with so many people sacrificing their Saturday afternoon, you better say something substantial and progressive. Now, SFU, from where I am coming, has the image of being a very radical and progressive institution, unpredictable at the moment, perhaps involved in more scandalous affairs than UBC, which is considered to be much more traditional. But I want to tell you, in our household, the conventional wisdom is reversed. The UBC-based partner is far more progressive and hypersensitive to the landmines of political correctness. And it was, as a victim of apartheid, it was Kogila who got me interested in South Africa first, who sensitized me and provided insights, and who sustained my interest in that strange society. In Canada, we talk about the distribution of spoils between the federal government and the provinces. In South Africa, they talk a lot about the big moral problems. South Africa is a microcosm of humanity, of all the global issues, of the major issues, the conflict between haves and have-nots, the conflict between North and South, and particularly the conflict of, or the problem of the coexistence between races. Now, while we in Vancouver also try a very unique experiment in multicultural coexistence, in South Africa, this experiment is burdened very much with the legacy of institutionalized racism and what to do about it. So this is in my topic tonight. What should a new democracy, or how should a new democracy deal with its unsavory past? How should a new democracy reckon with the torturers? There are not many societies, many countries in the world where a privileged ethnic minority has negotiated itself out of power, although I would argue it could have continued to rule well into the next century, albeit with rising costs. Even more rare, same situation where a dominant ethnic minority loses power peacefully to a different ethnic majority with whom it has now to coexist in the same state, despite a legacy of past discrimination and accumulated bitterness. The few examples I could think of includes the English in Quebec, the Russians in the Baltic states, and the Chinese in Malaysia. But in all these cases, there existed the option of relocation or support and protection of fellow ethnics by what we call neighboring kinship states, which facilitated the transfer of power. Only in the Afrikaner case does a new ethnic minority stand entirely on its own. So how did this extraordinary case of peaceful capitulation come about? And contrary to almost every available stereotype about the model personality type of the Afrikaner, when the chips were down, Afrikaner negotiators meekly handed over power without even seriously attempting to bargain any special group privileges. There were analyses abound describing the Afrikaner obduracy, the brutality, the almost suicidal instinct for self-preservation and collective survival. I want to read you perhaps one quote from a book by what I consider the two most acute, perceptive analysts of Afrikaner nationalism, Professor Herman Guillaume and Lawrence Schlemmer, who published in 1989 a book called Negotiating South Africa's Future. In their quote, they state, ultimately, Afrikaner nationalism goes beyond culture and involves a close emotional attachment with the state, with national institutions such as parliament and the army and national symbols and values. Much of the talk about a peaceful transition of power in South Africa misses a fundamental point, they said, namely that the Afrikaners and the larger white nation considers their sovereignty as precious. It is not something to be bartered away, quote end. Yet barter away they did, and the unlikely peaceful transition took place. The majority of Afrikaners has accepted the loss of political sovereignty and national symbols in exchange for keeping their wealth. The rich Afrikaners sold out their poor Afrikaners who clung to the symbols, the poorer section of such a group always cling to the symbolic power, but in exchange, the majority kept their wealth and the capitalist order. None of these analysts, therefore, seriously considered the possibility that Afrikaners could enthusiastically, through consensus-seeking negotiations, help to construct a process of dislodging themselves from power into a liberal democratic constitution. And they even agreed that political decision-making should be based on unqualified majority rule, knowing full well that this would be exercised by black South Africans, whom they had subjected to systematic apartheid domination for decades. And the big question is, of course, why? If we look at the literature, the most frequent answer to that question, recently in a book by Patty Waldmeier, is it was a miracle. She published a book called Anatomy of a Miracle. And of course, miracle is associated with divine intervention and doesn't explain anything. I don't know where the divine intervention was. But I want to argue among the many reasons that the relatively peaceful South African transition was greatly facilitated by the vast resources at the disposal of the state and the private sector-led economy. The negotiated revolution would not have been possible without the security of pensions and the incentive of vast retrenchment packages. And the literature on transition, I think, has underrated the availability of buyouts as a precondition for compromise by hardliners in power. In many ways, the so-called South African miracle could be called the purchased revolution. And that applies to both sides, because members of the liberation armies who were not incorporated into the official defense force also received a small pension. Many other potential troublemakers were bought off by being put on the payroll of the public service. And it was legal continuity and a relatively rich economy that allowed key security bureaucrats from the old regime to abandon control of the state peacefully for a golden handshake. Huge payouts were handed out to police generals who retired for health reasons or easily found alternative employment in the private sector. African military rulers and their underlings elsewhere who depend on the state as a main source of income cling to their power because they face not only loss of office, but economic insecurity unless they have siphoned off revenue into foreign bank accounts. But at the moral level, a purchased revolution amounts to a compromise that satisfies neither side. The elitist pact leaves a moral vacuum for activists who had been indoctrinated with notions of a just struggle and feel cheated out of victory by virtue of the fact that the old oppressors continue in their privileged roles in the economy and to a lesser extent in the civil service. The apartheid bureaucrats, on the other hand, resent being demonized by so-called terrorists, against whom they merely upheld, in their view, civilized standards of law and order. And since both have to coexist with each other, now they cannot vent their antagonisms as before, and I would argue instead they wage a symbolic war, a war about the moral high ground. And the grand spectacle of a public truth and reconciliation commission fulfills the need to clarify the moral winners and losers in the negotiated revolution. It is part of an ongoing struggle about political legitimacy and has little to do with learning from the past so that the past does not haunt the future. In addition, the compromise between the ANC and the Afrikaner state ignored other influential societal segments interested in the outcome of the long struggle. Domestic non-government organizations who had bravely sided with the ANC during the anti-apartheid protest found themselves increasingly marginalized by the returning exiles. The ANC simply absorbed and dissolved their United Democratic Front organization. And traditional liberals in the English language universities, in the alternative press, in many professions, and particularly in the churches, were neither part of the deal nor necessarily future beneficiaries. Initially sidelined to the role of interested onlookers, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, let me call it just for brevity's sake, now TRC, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, would bring them again into the center of the new order. The clergy and associates assumed the role of reconcilers and of arbitrators of the past. The international community, too, had been excluded from the negotiations, but was nevertheless keen to influence and shape the future. It was American private funds from George Soros who financed the initial important preparatory work for the TRC. And it was a European community, particularly Holland and Denmark, that generously assisted the TRC with police investigators, legal assistance, and funding. And paradoxically, many of the politicians centrally involved in the negotiations, including a skeptical Mandela and Thabo Mbeki, let alone the wary de Klerk, initially considered that the Truth Commission might undermine reconciliation. They had to be persuaded of the need for a cleansing exercise, if only for the sake of the victims. In effect, then, by 1995, the pressure to fill the moral void of the purchased revolution had built up to such an extent that all major political actors would have lost faith had they openly opposed investigating a past in which they said they had few actions to regret and nothing to hide. Only the form and scope of a truth commission remained controversial. And significantly, both the ANC and the National Party, the main antagonist, wished to limit publicly limit the publicity about the past. Alex Borain, the deputy chair of the Truth Commission, recently wrote, quote, "There was a stage in that debate when the majority of the parties in parliament agreed that the proceedings should be closed. And it was at the interventions of the NGOs, the non-government organizations, that a strong demand was made that the legislation be amended so that the hearings were in public." And then, of course, there was the obvious temptation to exploit the past for their own purpose. The specter of delegitimizing a political opponent by dragging corpses out of the closet, however, did not reckon with the high moral trauma developing its own dynamics beyond the control of its scriptwriters, with all the state's main actors at the center stage. If you look comparatively, and I want to compare South Africa quite a bit with other situations, particularly Germany, if we look at it comparatively and see how analysts of the politics of memory have written about such cases, they have basically identified four basic ways in which a new democracy can deal with its unsavory past. The first way is amnesia, or forgetting, which was practiced in the Spanish transition from Franco, from the Franco dictatorship. It was practiced in post-war Japan and Russia. Churchill, too, spoke of, quote, a blessed act of oblivion in 1946. And I think if you look at Spain and Japan, so one could say that democracy does not necessarily depend on what the Germans call Geschichtsbewältigung or Vergangenheitsaufarbeitung, the grappling with the past the way Germany did it relatively successfully. The second way to deal with an unsavory past is disqualifying all those involved from public service, from public office, particularly practiced now in the Czech Republic, where they call it lustration. Lustration means sort of a cleansing ritual, and in the former East Germany, the GDR. However, the disqualification of civil servants presupposes skilled substitutes who are not available in sufficient numbers due to South Africa's apartheid education. The acceptance of the compromise in South Africa also relied on the continued tenure of the Afrikaner bureaucrats. 42% of all employed Afrikaners were employed by the state or parastatal public corporations. That was a unique nation of civil servants. I think the equivalent number in Canada would be about 5% or 6%. Here it was 42%. There is a third way, of course, in which society deals with its past, namely tribunals or trials, a la Nuremberg. But they are the hallmark of victors. And in contrast, the South African transition was based on a continuing stalemate. Neither side had been defeated. So there's a fourth option, namely truth commissions, which were first practiced in Latin America, in Chile, in Argentina, in Guatemala, in Uruguay. They represent a unique compromise between war tribunals and dealing with past atrocities on both sides by ignoring them. Amnesia in South Africa would have shortchanged millions of victims of racial laws and weakened the moral foundations of the new order. Imposing justice or revenge, on the other hand, was ruled out by the need for reconciliation in an ethnically divided societies. The bilateral indemnity for past crimes formed a crucial precondition for the relatively peaceful changeover of political power. So amnesty upon full disclosure proved a mutually acceptable formula for future coexistence. And so the TRC came into being, or was conceived with basically three different tasks, each reflected in different subcommittees. The first task was an investigative function of ascertaining the truth about gross human rights violations and granting amnesty on this basis. The second task was a therapeutic one of providing a platform for victims to tell their story, to recognize their suffering officially and publicly, provide counseling and consolation for survivors. And third, a compensatory task to provide financial or symbolic restitution to victims in the form of pensions, one-time compensations or even symbolic recognition, such as memorials. However, I want to argue the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission faces several major predicaments. I have identified five, and I would label them first the problem of legislated reconciliation, second, official truth and common memory, third, individual culpability versus collective benefits, fourth, knowledge without acknowledgement, and fifth, blame and identity maintenance. And perhaps you allow me to sketch these five predicaments in turn. Legislated reconciliation. Revealing the truth is said to reconcile the nation, but the very opposite could also happen. The more gory the revelations, the greater the clamor for justice through retribution. In short, the very truth can undermine reconciliation, and herein lies a basic contradiction of the South African Commission. Sacrificing justice for truth, trading justice for truth, is readily acknowledged by the architects of the TRC, because, as one of them, Kada Asmal, wrote, the pains of justice may traumatize our country, and it helps to consolidate democracy by avoiding continuing confrontation with the former power holders. However, this argument neglects the possibility of a different confrontation with those denied justice, incited and traumatized by the very amnesty that was supposed to de-traumatize the nation. The TRC's necessary evil compromise, that's how Tutu described it, assumes only a white backlash if redress through courts were possible, and neglects the rage of the victims against clemency. And I want to show two short video clips from a recent BBC-CBC film made by Michael Ignatieff. Some of you may have seen it some weeks ago on CBC, on The National, which shows precisely the reaction and also the faces of torturers, which we will later analyze when we look at how Hannah Arendt did it. So let us look perhaps for a second at this first video clip.
Rise for the amnesty commissioners. This is a courtroom after all. Joyce and Sapiwo's daughter are 20 feet away from the men who killed him. Mr. X can now be publicly named, the torturer Gideon Nebot. Herit Erasmus, the commander who ordered the elimination. Nick van Rensburg, who pulled the trigger. And Herman Duplessis, who was also involved in the murder. To get amnesty, they have to prove a political motive.
Carry the two outside? Yes, that is correct. Did you then shoot Sipho and Tumkulu? Yes, that is correct. What did you do with the corpses after this? We placed them on the firewood. We first put down a layer of firewood, and then we put the corpses on top of the firewood. And then you poured this dieseline over them. Is that correct? Yes, that is correct. Was the fire then lit with the purpose of burning the corpses? Yes.
During the course of the evening, on several occasions, you had to keep the fire going and put on more wood, that is so, Your Honor. The next morning, did you gather the remains? and throw these into the fish river. That is correct.
At the end of the hearings, Sapiro's daughter leads a demonstration to prevent the perpetrators from leaving. To the end, they deny any part in his poisoning. If amnesty is granted, many people here believe the killers will have got away with murder.
I have not forgiven them. Why must I forgive them? When they don't want to tell the truth. And the beauty part of this, they are not asking forgiveness from us, the people who have lost their beloved ones. They are asking forgiveness from the government. They did not do nothing to the government. What they did to us.
The advocates of the TRC who defend the institution argue, of course, that political criminals are beyond rehabilitation because of their ideological fanaticism, that conviction would be difficult and costly to secure in an overburdened court justice system, that would be confronted with shredded evidence, and that confessions for amnesty therefore provides the only chance for survivors and relatives to know what happened and who is responsible. All these valid arguments against adversarial litigation merely underscore the fact that individual justice is sacrificed for a higher level of stability of the social order. And this social justice of pragmatically securing peace for the majority at the expense of the justifiable claims of a minority, I would argue, can be as legitimately defended and prioritized as individual justice. It has also been pointed out that reconciliation amounts to the imposition of a religious value on unwilling participants. Noble gestures of forgiveness are mocked and exploited by popular demagogues who find themselves investigated for their misdeeds. As you all have read in the paper recently, Winnie Mandela, for example, complains, quote, "When the TRC treats me like a leper and its chairperson," meaning Bishop Tutu, "hugs our former oppressors, then I worry what type of reconciliation we are fostering, she means. Forgiveness cannot be engineered by bringing perpetrators and victims into contact. And I would argue that only victims can forgive. And also some crimes remain literally unforgivable. Therefore, a strong minority opinion in South Africa holds that no government or leader has a moral authority to grant a people's pardon to their erstwhile oppressors, since here's a consent and participation of neither party has been solicited and procured. And this position has been adopted and even legally pursued by prominent South African survivors such as the Biko, the Mthengi, and Ribeiro families. But one can also argue that the people, through their elected ANC representatives, as well as their opposition, negotiated precisely such a consent. Initially inclined to indemnify themselves, the ANC and the National Party at least concurred with the ritual of public confessions before the pardon. Amnesty, however, does not require remorse that could expediently be feigned. headed by two clergymen and a theologian as a chief research officer. The TRC thinking, unfortunately, slips frequently into the theological discourse of atonement and repentance. When Tutu feels, quote, deeply distressed that the clerk's, about the clerk's denial of culpability for gruesome acts committed by his security forces that negate his apology for apartheid, I think he applies religious assumptions of absolution requiring remorse. Absolution by a well-meaning former archbishop is limited to the faithful who value healing or the African philosophy of Ubuntu. This philosophy suggests that your own humanity can only be realized by recognizing the human qualities of your enemy. This remarkable forgiveness also resonates well with the Buddhist tradition. Recently, the Burmese Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi published a book where she says she feels even, quote, affection for the oppressor. She emphasizes the potential of rehabilitation and says, quote, that although he has done that deed, it does not mean that he is irredeemable. Anyone who is broad-minded will know that a murderer is not wholly a murderer, quote end, from the Burmese Nobel laureate. Timothy Garton Ash, however, has pointed out recently, quote, that reconciliation of all with all is a deeply illiberal idea. Some values are irreconcilable, and liberalism teaches how to coexist tolerantly with irreconcilable conflicts rather than engineer totalitarian closure or normative homogeneity. Let me come to the issue of an official truth and common memory. Claiming that truth made public is itself a form of justice, that claim may be true for the victims who have their sufferings publicly recognized and their dignity restored. The perpetrators, however, emerge unashamed, claiming they merely fulfilled orders or fought a war against alleged foreign communists who are now fellow citizens. Torturers are said to be punished through public shaming. However, this presupposes a moral reference group that most perpetrators avoid by isolating themselves happily in their own ethno-racial enclave with similar beliefs. Yet, seeing former regime representatives admit to and apologize for their misdeeds is in itself a gain. Nobody can now deny past atrocities. As Michael Ignatieff has written at another place, quote, truth commissions can reduce the number of permissible lies in a society, quote end. The Orwellian skepticism about an official truth notwithstanding. But the goals of the commission in South Africa aim at something more ambitious, namely a new written history, as some commissioner said. Borain writes that South Africans desperately need to create a common memory. Another commissioner speaks of, quote, establishing a publicly sanctioned history, which can be taught in schools. And the historian Herman Guillaume, one of the most vocal TRC skeptics, has criticized this as a mindset of totalitarian systems, quote, with the concomitant idea that those who question the official historical truths have to be severely punished. In response, the TRC said that Hillary is paranoid. And I would say it is hard to envisage how 17 commissioners could arrive at a common history, even if they have, as one commissioner says, reach deep into the most cruel and lonely corners of our national psyche, quote ends. Hundreds of professional historians have not accomplished this task in more homogeneous societies. And it is naive to expect contradictory versions of history to be wiped out. Recording past atrocities as necessary as this exercise is, does not establish common ground among warring factions. Nation building does not flow mechanically from an official history. Such claims will inevitably be challenged by those whose interests are shortchanged by the publicly sanctioned version of the past. A Canadian philosopher in Ottawa, Wilkin Licker, has pointed out that successful nation building may even presuppose amnesia, quote, in as far as to build a common identity in a multinational state probably requires an even more selective memory of the past, quote end. And not all national minorities are likely to accept such a devaluation of their history in equal fashion, as Kim Licker suggests. Resistance to amnesia will obviously originate more from the vanquished than the victors, because they can lay claims for compensation, liberation, or simply the moral high ground from their suffering. I would argue that a more realistic view points to history as a never-ending argument. A more moderate educational goal hopes for the permanent critical engagement with contradictory interpretations of the past. And such a perspective does not invalidate the achievements of truth commissions that unearth new evidence under difficult circumstances. But the skepticism towards a publicly sanctioned history merely pricks inflated claims for a more realistic and ultimately truer scenario of a cacophony of voices without consensus. And I don't have to go into the debate about postmodern relativism, where teaching a common truth is considered an impossible claim, and where it is argued that the truth of one party is a lie for the other side. Perhaps one could settle for two kinds of truth. A factual truth, that an historical event took place, and secondly, an interpretative truth concerning the meaning of the event. For example, nobody of a sound mind should be allowed to deny the Holocaust. But at the same time, there can be many legitimate explanations as to what caused the Holocaust and what it meant to the victims and perpetrators. In summary, then, claims that truth commissions can heal a torn nation through a shared truth can be disputed, both because the truth is liable to be constructed differently by competing interests, and also because nations do not possess collective psyches. Guilt can therefore be ascribed only individually and not collectively. It is doubtful whether a traumatized nation can be cured by having a repressed memory restored, as it is claimed in South Africa. And these medical metaphors are misleading when applied to social collectivities. The benefit of tribunals or truth commissions lies precisely in disaggregating the misdeeds of individuals from the blame of all. And from this perspective, the South African Truth Commission serves the opposite of what an Afrikaner leader, Constant Viljoen, called the exercise in Afrikaner bashing. Let me come to the third predicament, the individual culpability versus the collective benefits. A white editor of an influential South African Sunday paper, the Sunday Independent, by the name of John Battersby, recently wrote, quote, only a collective apology from the white community can lead to real reconciliation. Not only does his demand presuppose again, collective guilt, falsely including those whites who opposed apartheid, but it leaves unresolved who can speak for a deeply divided racial collective. However, I would argue all whites were beneficiaries regardless of their attitudes. Even white apartheid opponents could not escape the material advantages and symbolic status that arbitrary racial membership bestowed upon them. For example, differential wages for employees with the same jobs and qualifications, vastly different educational, medical, and living conditions in first world suburbs versus impoverished townships. That all legally privileged race as nowhere else in the world. And a leading Africanist, Mahmoud Mamdani, at the University of Cape Town, has pointed to the difference between Rwanda, where there are many perpetrators but few beneficiaries of genocide, and apartheid South Africa with few perpetrators and many beneficiaries. So the focus of the TRC on gross human rights violations obliterates the beneficiaries of systemic discrimination and the countless ordinary victims of apartheid. Should the beneficiaries pay compensation? Can victims and beneficiaries be defined in racial terms? As there were also black beneficiaries and white victims. Can there be reconciliation without economic justice? Quite obviously, the impoverished parents who lost their child, the single mother who mourns her husband, or the brain-damaged survivors of torture clearly cry out for financial compensation. However, can the degree of suffering be differentiated financially, just as insurance companies calculate different rates for different kinds of mutilations? Should there be a means test? In short, can pain be measured and impartially flagged with a price tag? Realizing all these difficulties, the TRC has recently recommended equal annual this would amount to 0.25% of the national budget, but even this token gesture is likely to be substantially scaled down by a government committed to reducing the budget deficit. Whether private business would chip in to foot the reparations bill through a one-time corporate tax or more general wealth tax is equally doubtful. Let me come to the fourth predicament, knowledge versus acknowledgement. Unlike the Chilean Commission, the TRC is essentially a public and democratic enterprise. It was established as a parliamentary commission, forged through heated public debates, public hearings about the suitability of commissioners and regularly televised proceedings. Hence, the TRC reflected the new political power relations with the representatives of the old regime underrepresented, unlike the parity of the 8-person Chilean commission. And also charged with quasi-judicial impartiality by the Promotion of National Unity and Reconciliation Act, and staffed by commissioners, quote, who do not have a high political profile. Most commissioners, most of the 17 persons on the commission played highly active roles in the long anti-apartheid struggle. And it would be hard to find any what the legislation calls fit and proper person with a low political profile in a highly politicized society. So the TRC is also accused of letting political bias influence its procedures and judgments. Professor Hillumi has charged the TRC, quote, with concentrating at a ratio of 22 to 2
on acts committed by officials of the old regime and failure to select evidence on human rights violations of the liberation forces. Indeed, I would have argued the Commission could have subpoenaed more individual ANC leaders rather than letting them off by claiming collective responsibility. Yet the massive accumulation of evidence about atrocities of apartheid state agents, together with majority pressure, also overwhelmed the Commission. Hence, the perceived leanings of most commissioners, and particularly their 300-person staff, towards a broad ANC version of history that affected the legitimacy of the TRC in the eyes of competing parties whose leaders feared to be perpetually discredited. And this impression was reinforced, of course, by the harrowing accounts of victims seeking acknowledgement and hopefully some compensation. So, unlike the dramatic impact of the Argentinian Nunca Mas report, which was released after long in-camera investigations about the disappeared, Nunca Mas was spread over 3 years, or is being spread over 3-4 years in South Africa. The names of the perpetrators are not kept secret, but the faces of the torturers appear each day in the South African media. And such a public discourse undoubtedly contributes to historical education or political immunization. But whether it establishes a unifying truth, as Tutu claims, is highly questionable. So despite the expectations of the old security establishment, no blanket and collective amnesty was granted. Instead, amnesty was made contingent on full disclosure by individuals and demonstration that their crimes were politically motivated and proportional to their assigned role in the conflict. And this trade-off between full confessions and amnesty has not been practiced anywhere else. Amnesty applicants are not granted their request automatically, but are subject to investigation and cross-examination in a public inquiry, or if the Commission deems it necessary, in-camera hearings. And only if perpetrators disclose what they did, why they did it, and who ordered them to do so, do they meet the conditions for clemency. And as I said earlier, in this way, justice is traded for truth. Also, some evasive perpetrators have been recommended for persecution. But whether the threat of future prosecutions of those who refuse to apply for amnesty will be realized remains to be seen. The success rate is rather mixed with regard to senior political actors. The top military brass had nothing to reveal, as did most senior apartheid politicians. Leaders of the Zulu-based IFP boycotted the TRC as an instrument of their ANC enemies. Yet the police chiefs revealed and related their stories to the Commission, mostly out of spite for the civilian bosses of the National Party, whom they perceived as refusing to take responsibility for their own orders. And this breaking of the ranks of a once solid ethno-nationalist supremacy clarified the lines of command. Also, the originators of most atrocities were long known. So while the TRC officially confirms widespread knowledge, it has mostly failed to secure acknowledgement. However, even if the unlikely case were true that the clerk, as chief executive of the state, suspected or knew nothing of the misdeeds of his security forces, one could still expect an acknowledgement of the atrocities, because they were committed in the name of the apartheid state and its defense. So in different societies, different euphemisms, as we all know, signal the order to kill to the foot soldiers. There was a decorated Croat police official by the name of Mercer who uttered, "Clean up all that shit," and meant Serb prisoners were to be liquidated. Afrikaner police generals suggested that ons soll a plan machen. We should make a plan. And the underlings understood what that meant. Another signal read that an activist should, quote, be removed from society permanently. Now, the members of the State Security Council now all maintain that such phrases meant detaining rather than killing. And the search of the TRC for explicit orders proves fruitless because no such commands were necessary. Or if they had been made explicit, they would not have been recorded, as Pik Botha pointed out, the former foreign minister. Therefore, apartheid politicians cannot be easily accused of acts of commission, but they are clearly guilty of omission. So the politicians hide behind what is legally known as plausible deniability. They continue to receive their fat state pensions while the foot soldiers carry the can and are justifiably angry with their former bosses. And there is, of course, the possibility that the TRC reinforces a fallacy that the past has been put behind the nation. What the Germans in 1945 called the Stunde Null, the hour zero. As if a new counting has begun despite the continuing legacy of an abominable past. Instead of actively engaging with the past, Adorno warned, the past is always in danger of being committed to oblivion through the process of accounting for it once and for all. So the ultimate success of the TRC will be measured not in how complete or accurate a picture of the past it will paint, but in how much future political education it will generate. Walter Benjamin has suggested that proper mourning consists of recalling past injustices in order to nourish current struggles for emancipation. Notions of justice are derived from the narratives of past iniquities. Also, as Nietzsche has reminded us, a consciousness shaped solely by the vanquished dead forgets the living. I leave out my section on the issue of how difficult it is to get actually an ethnic collectivity or leaders of an ethnic collectivity to admit blame, and how difficult it is to get professional organizations like business, the media, the medical profession, often colluded with the police, to admit their wrongdoing. The TRC had invited them, but they admitted that they could have done something more, but given the circumstances, they did their best, so they sidestepped the real issues. Let me come to and conclude with Hannah Arendt, who perhaps of all analysts of political evil has probably come closest to conveying the pathetic mediocrity of the bureaucratic criminal. After observing the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem, she concluded that the horrendous Nazi crimes were not committed by psychopathic monsters, but ordinary common characters, killers who otherwise looked and behaved like you and me. And the shallow facelessness of apartheid murderers has also struck many observers of the South African amnesty hearings. For example, 3 weeks ago, the front page headline of the New York Times read, "As evil shows its banal face," and it reports, "Jeffrey Benzin was one of the many minor but effective functionaries who made apartheid work for South Africa's white government. Every day, the paunchy, graying police officer left his home in this city's tidy suburbs and went to a police barracks where he extracted confessions with torture." I want to show you a 3-minute clip of that very person, Jeffrey Benzin.
Concede that in all probability I did. I don't know how though.
In the new South Africa, this man is now Jeff Benzin's boss.
I was blindfolded and then the bag was used on me. I would want to be given the opportunity by the commission to see what it did to me with my own eyes.
Because the victims were blindfolded, this is the first chance they've had to see what was done to them. While the Amnesty commissioners stand and watch, Jeff Benzin is made to demonstrate how he drew a wet bag over a victim's head until he nearly suffocated. The idea is to reenact the torture so that it will never be part of the new South Africa.
What kind of man uses a method like this one of the wet bag to people, to other human beings, repeatedly, and listening to those moans and cries and groans, and taking each of those people very near to their deaths? What kind of man is that?
Not only you have asked me that question. I, Jeff Benzin, have asked myself that question to such an extent that I voluntarily approached psychiatrists to have myself evaluated to find out what type of person am I. There was a stage when this whole scene was going on, that I thought I was losing my mind.
In contrast, probably, to the Nazis, which had turned around the legal order and made crime righteousness, most of the apartheid torturers and certainly the political bosses were conscious of their immorality. The Afrikaner political leaders all professed to not knowing, and had they known, not tolerating the murder of opponents. So while they certainly can be viewed as a shabby excuse for human rights violations by omission, it also testifies to a need to affirm standards of behavior that Hitler or Stalin could ignore. And we mustn't forget that apartheid ruled through the law that pretended to apply equally to whites and blacks alike. Unlike Jews, who were placed outside of the law, apartheid required the appearance of due process to secure the compliance of a majority population. The rule of law appealed to international legitimacy, and above all, the belief in just rule over colonized subjects was necessary for the moral self-concept of the overlords themselves. Let me conclude with linking what we have seen in, and considered in South Africa, with some recent events in Vancouver. Because torture and oppression of entire people continues in many parts of the world. In Vancouver, we have just welcomed the leading culprits in the murder of 1/3 of the East Timor population, of the long-standing oppression in Tibet, and several less publicized prosecutions of trade unionists and political dissidents in other APEC countries. whether the torturers are mainly white, as during apartheid, black as in Nigeria, brown as in Indonesia, or yellow as in China, is irrelevant. South African white minority rule evoked moral outrage because of its reminder of slavery and external European colonization. But the ongoing internal colonization by own group members ought to be as strongly rebuked. And there was a time when Canada was a leader in guarding human rights worldwide, when Diefenbaker initiated the expulsion of South Africa from the Commonwealth in 1961, or when Joe Clark and the Mulroney government publicly battled Margaret Thatcher for sanctions against South Africa. Ironically, it is a liberal government that has relegated human rights to cozy fireside chats. Both Clinton and Chrétien say they bring up the thorny, sensitive issue in private conversations with their murderous counterparts. Yet massive human rights violations constitute the principal public issue, a topic for public debate and public pressure, even if the guest is offended. In Vancouver, in some examples, you couldn't even hold up a placard outside the security zone with free speech and democracy written on it without being arrested. And the arrests were made out of anxiety about offending foreign leaders. I would argue it is probably inevitable that liberal democracies must have normal diplomatic contact and formal interstate relations, perhaps even trade with dictatorships, particularly when these regimes are affluent. And a cynic may argue that Canadian sanctions against apartheid were only possible because our trade with South Africa was so small, about 1% of total exports and imports. However, the current moral schizophrenia not only deals with dictators, but it celebrates them. The Senate of the University of Victoria unabashedly honored the Chinese president with the offer of an academic degree. The City Council of Vancouver falls over itself to dine and wine foreign dignitaries with bloodied hands. And even Mandela, who should know better, betrays his own legacy by conferring the country's highest award on Suharto in order to gain leverage and thank a financial backer of the ANC in the past. The University of Victoria had hoped to gain some cheap publicity and donations. Canadian corporations undoubtedly will gain more contracts in a competitive world. Vancouver will attract more tourists and local merchants more orders. UBC can revel in the dubious glory of having hosted the most powerful world leaders. The few student activists left have made their point bravely for the international media. And the RCMP proved that they earned their salary and tarnished their image at the same time. In the process, we have also sold out our soul and revealed our moral bankruptcy. The prisoners in the dungeons and labor camps of Asia have lost one more country of hope. We have also shown that in our creed and in our deference to authority, we are not so morally superior to the torturers of apartheid, whom we so smugly despise. Thank you for listening.
Dr. Adam will now take questions and comments, and I just ask you to speak as loudly as you can, and I will ask him to try to summarize and repeat the questions so everybody can hear. Dr. Adam.
Please, sir.
Should those who were judges in the apartheid be encouraged, restrained, come before the people? What are your opinions on the underlying questions of people who are assigned orders to answer?
Let me repeat the question, is whether judges should come before the TRC and give evidence. In fact, the judges were invited. They made written submissions, but none of the judges appeared personally before the TRC, even the few black judges, 90% of judges in South Africa still white, didn't appear, because they didn't want to give the impression of, as one of them said, compromising the integrity of the courts, and they argued if they were to appear before the TRC, the TRC would set itself up as a high court comprised of laymen, of lay people, who do not apply tested legal procedures to find the truth. So the judiciary in South Africa has sidestepped its responsibility, and I would argue it was in the past on the whole, and this is very arguable, very much part of the system, even if when there was some latitude in sentencing, most judges did not use it, but unthinkingly complied to apply the racist apartheid laws. Yes, sir. Yes, that's correct. Amnesty applications had to be in by May of this year. After that date, no more amnesties can be offered. The person questions whether after now amnesty applications are closed, the hearings could provide the basis for future prosecutions. No, that is unlikely, because by law what has been revealed before the commission cannot be used both for civil action or for prosecutions, but what can happen is that attorney generals, if they so decide, can prosecute people who have not applied for amnesty on the basis of new evidence. Yes, sir. Mr. Kobikon.
Last minute they backed away from it because all the parties said you will, you are threatening the Paris peace process. And so the community never came to grips with what genocide means, despite all the declarations about it. Secondly, with regard to Bosnia, as you know, Dayton almost fell over the issue of whether the leaders, particularly the Serbian leaders, would be subject to trial. And in that case, of course, Judge Goldstone played a major role in attempting to stand for justice. Now, I guess it's an ethic of the law that mankind is the type of creature it is, needs a coercive element in order to maintain publicly accepted norms. And so internationally, the issue has been between accountability and peace, if you will. And so all of this makes me wonder what alternative models were considered in South Africa before this one was decided. Was there a discussion, and what were some of the other proposals?
Have you heard the question? The question was whether there were any alternative models considered before it, the TRC was established. Yes, there was a long, long discussion. The obvious alternative was let's forgive and forget. That was actually what Mandela said. Let's look to the future. And a lot of people pointed out while one can forgive, one should never forget one's past. Then the more conservative academics argued that actually that should be left to the historians to thrash out. Archives should be opened, and the historians in public argument, like in Germany where they had that famous Historikerstreit, should then establish or try to come closer to the meaning of that past. That was rejected mainly because of the pressure of victims. And regarding the Yugoslav analogy, I don't think it applies in South Africa because in Yugoslavia we have an international issue. In South Africa it is purely how a society domestically, how a state domestically handles coming to grips with its past. Yes, sir. Yes, what I'm saying is probably very controversial and very contentious. Let me say it anyway. The Winnie Mandela issue is actually a sideshow. Winnie Mandela is a tragic case where a brave woman with impeccable credentials has become a victim of circumstances. She was banned, as you know, for a long time, isolated from her husband for 20 years during the best years of her life. And that fact actually destroyed her almost personally. She became megalomaniac. She didn't follow the discipline of the ANC, and she probably committed many of the acts she has been accused of. But she is popular. She is, I almost thought someone should make a sort of analogy with Diana. She's a South African celebrity based on scandals, based on threatening the established hierarchy with actions which the hierarchy considers as a threat.
And for that reason, the hearings about Winnie Mandela have actually been scheduled at the end of the Drews Commission, clearly with the intent to discredit her further. But in the South African struggle, a strange thing has happened. I mean, morality has been sort of turned upside down. While on the one hand, violence has been abhorred, it has also been celebrated, and Mrs. Mandela's violence is not viewed in the sort of same light as we would see such acts, strangely enough. So this is a battle for legitimacy, and which faction will win out, the sort of populist demagogues like she has become, or the more established leadership now. Yes, sir. Yeah. The question is about the likely successor of President Mandela, who announced his retirement for 1999. And this likely successor has clearly been and will be a person by the name of Thabo Mbeki. Thabo Mbeki is a very suave politician, a skilled diplomat, sane, sober, pragmatic, non-ideological person who is, however, much more at home in the boardrooms of business than before a huge crowd in a stadium. The major weakness of his successor will not be that he will have much new policy on the whole. I think actually economically the successor of Mandela will move to the right. Mbeki is responsible for the macroeconomic policy of the ANC, which is now almost to the right of the World Bank, while at the same time engaging in a kind of socialist rhetoric, we are the representative of the poorest of the poor. So the question for the successor of Mandela is whether he can market his policies as effectively as his predecessor, whose stature and whose mystique has grown even in office. Mandela is now even more popular than he was when he came out of prison. The other weakness of Thabo Mbeki is that he surrounds himself mainly with people who are considered to be yes-sayers, who think likewise, and it is always unwise for a politician not to have a reality principle of advisors who tell him the truth. Perhaps one more question. Yes, sir.
It's not really a question, sir. I hope I don't misunderstand you. You made a remark which you suggested that UBC was close to the APEC conference. Now, I did appreciate your saying to us at the end that as Canadians we should not feel complacent about human rights violations and that indeed some of these can be laid on our doorstep. And I don't feel complacent in saying that the APEC conference. The UGC are the students of the professorial
Mm-hmm. The gentleman, if you have not heard, pointed out that UBC did not really host the APEC conference, that the students and the professoriate were very much against that event, and that the property was almost sort of confiscated or leased by the federal government and outside of the control of the UBC administration. As someone coming from SFU, I don't want to comment on this. I leave it to the UBC administration. Thank you.
Before I call on the Dean of Arts from Simon Fraser University to thank our speaker, let me just remind you that the complimentary ticket to the concert and lecture next week can be picked up at the table as you go out. Dr. Pierce.
Hello, I'm John Pierce, Dean of the Faculty of Arts at SFU. Herbert, I believe that you have no concerns about an evening of substance here. Seldom do we hear an academic lecture which penetrates to the heart of our understanding of such a current social problem. This has been a very timely talk, and I might add, a timeless talk. South Africa is very much in the news these days, and Herbert Adams' analysis and interpretation of the TRC provides us with the insights necessary to appreciate the complex undercurrents of the real politics of coexistence in South Africa. The soundness and policy relevance of this analysis is further evidenced by the attention his most recent co-published book, Comrades in Business, Post-Liberation Politics in South Africa, has attracted in the South African press. In fact, it made number 7 on the South African bestseller list. And of course, it's been a must-read in political circles. And I know that it's been reported that a number of very senior ministers considered this to be important reading. I'm not quite sure who it was. It may have been Nadine Gordimer, who once commented on the racial and political divisions existing in South Africa to the effect that there were no solutions, only alternatives. Perhaps the TRC can contribute to solutions, however imperfect. As Herbert Adams suggested this evening, the ultimate success of the TRC will be measured not in how complete or accurate a picture of the past it will paint, but in how much future political education it will generate. We are indebted to Herbert Adams for bringing his insights to our attention this evening, and you are an inspiration to us all. I thank you very much, Herbert, and thank you also to the Vancouver Institute for sponsoring this talk. Good night. Thank you.